Welcome to the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, is Arsen Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And we're so excited. We've won recently an award for our podcast, which we'll talk a little bit more about in the After Hours of the Radio Book Club segment, which is a podcast-only version of this. But for this radio broadcast of the Radio Book Club, we're delighted to have in the studio Rebecca Mackay, and her latest novel is The Great Believers. Arsen, before we greet Rebecca, tell us why you chose this book.
Well, I've been a fan of Rebecca's since she started publishing short stories and her first novel, The Borrowers. And also, I thought this book really captures a time and a place and a very important moment in fairly recent history that it seems like is not talked about enough. And I thought it would be a great read. I think Rebecca's going to be a great guest. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, we're delighted to have Rebecca here. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you in the book club studio. And this time that Arsen refers to, in fact, there are two time periods that kind of meet, I suppose, at the end of the book. But it's in the mid-1980s in Chicago, really at the height, I suppose, of the AIDS crisis. And then we have another period of time, 2015, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But this 1980s period, why did you choose that?
The answer is kind of long and boring and way off topic, but I'll give you the very brief version of it, which is that I set out to write a novel about a woman who'd been an artist's model in 1920s Paris, which is now maybe 5% of the book. She's in there as a character, but it was really going to be about her at the end of her life, looking back, and her relationship with some kind of art guy, trying to convince him that the originally one painting turned into a bunch of sketches that she had of herself from that time were authentic. I figured she couldn't have lived much past the 80s, just doing some math there. And so now I had an art guy in the 80s, and I felt at that point like maybe AIDS would be a subplot, it would be the background, and ultimately decided to kind of run headlong into all of that mess, all of those issues. That was where the gravity of the book ended up being for me. So it turned into that.
Well, there is that side story, I suppose, of that woman who was an artist model in the 1920s. But as you said, really the plot became centered on the AIDS crisis. Now, why Chicago, though? Why not, say, San Francisco, which really was the heart, I suppose, of gay America in the 1980s and really was hit hard by the AIDS crisis?
Yeah, oh boy. Okay. So first of all, I'm from Chicago. I've lived there my whole life. I wanted to write about Chicago. And I know, you know, from having lived there my whole life, that AIDS hit Chicago very hard. Chicago had, still does, but really, especially in the 80s, had a very concentrated gay population in this one neighborhood called Boys Town. And it hit there devastatingly hard. And Chicago is the third largest city in America. So here's the thing. I go to find all of the nonfiction books that I'm sure are out there about AIDS in Chicago. There is nothing. And then I look in the index of various, you know, kind of compendious big newer books about AIDS, How to Survive a Plague by David France, for instance. Chicago's not in the index. And it upset me. It still upsets me. I've written a novel. Someone still needs to write the 500-page nonfiction account of this particular city's history with AIDS, the way it grappled with it. And someone needs to do the same for a million other cities. Milwaukee, for instance, has a really unique story with the AIDS epidemic that I could not shoehorn into this book. The more that I realized what wasn't out there, the more I felt an urgency to set my story there and do this research. I found some things. It's not that there's literally nothing. There are some personal accounts. There is one short film that's very hard to find that I managed to watch about the founder of ACT UP in Chicago. A lot of personal accounts online. Since I started researching, there's a wonderful graphic memoir that's been published by a woman who was an AIDS nurse in Chicago. It's called Taking Turns. But there's very little. And honestly, you know, the why beyond I'm from Chicago, I love Chicago, I love writing about Chicago, is we have heard the stories. We should not stop telling them. They should be, you know, there should be hundreds and hundreds more. But the stories about San Francisco and New York are the ones we've maybe heard, if we're paying attention. the ones about Chicago, unless you live there and are really listening hard, or you were there when it happened, these are not stories we have out there. So it made a book that already felt urgent for me feel even more urgent.
So the story is centered around the 1980s part of the story, centered around Yale. He's the art guy from Northwestern who comes to look at these sketches, and it's his cohort. And the book opens at a memorial. And at this point in time, the question is, you know, the test has come out, but not everybody's willing to take the test. And I was very fascinated about how, as an author, you have this group, maybe a dozen people, and you've got to have this. You're kind of writing a novel. You're not trying to write nonfiction, but you've got to figure out, okay, who's going to get AIDS, who's not going to get AIDS.
Yeah.
How did that feel as an author? And did some of your own decisions surprise you in the process?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking that. That's something that troubled me tremendously as I wrote. First of all, it troubled me on the emotional level because your characters become very real to you. And then, you know, you are not only having to, kill people off, but you're having to choose who lives and who dies, which is very unpleasant emotionally. On top of it, I really had philosophical issues with all of this because there was so much blame and there was so much scrutiny on cause and effect. And, in my looking at this group of friends and going, okay, this person's going to get sick, this one isn't, this one's going to get sick, but they're going to make it, this one's going to get sick and they aren't going to make it. I needed to resist the most obvious logic in many ways of, you know, well, the most promiscuous people are the ones who are going to get it. That's not the way it worked necessarily. I also needed, you know, I needed to get the brutal randomness of this disease across. And almost every decision that I made seemed to feel like an indictment in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, if I gave it to someone who had been very cautious, then it felt like, well, you know, everyone's just going to get it. If I gave it to someone who'd been promiscuous, that felt like an indictment. And I actually funneled a lot of that frustration into a speech that one of my characters makes at a certain point. He kind of goes through this, you know, if you get it because of this, you think this. If you get it because of this, you think this. Those were very much frustrations that I had as the author. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, 30 years later writing it as fiction, and I'm, you know, sweating it out. I'm also interviewing the people who are talking about the fact that they haven't been able to stop wondering for 30 years why they didn't get it, or why mm-hmm. they got it but they're still here, or why their friend got it and died.
Well, there's survivor's guilt, which actually I had to explain to my daughter last night as I was talking about this book and how some people seem to have survivor's guilt in the book. But one of the things I thought was interesting is the characters themselves also, and this has to be very true, I'm sure, at the times, are their first reaction is to blame or to assign blame or assign a cause, and then they try to pull back from that. Like they don't want to implicate their friends or their, you know, whatever. But even somebody who in the book, Julian, who is quite promiscuous in the book, it comes out that he feels pretty sure he knows who he got it from, which I thought was kind of surprising.
Yeah. It was something that, you know, so much of my research, because there wasn't anything in book form really, was one-on-one interviews. And I did so many interviews with not only survivors, but doctors, nurses, activists, journalists, historians, lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, ended up being in many ways psychological research and emotional research in addition to factual research. And that was an interesting thing that kept coming up, that when I was talking to people who were living with HIV, especially certainly people who've been, who'd contracted the virus much more recently, in an era of maybe constant testing, did have, you know, might have a very good sense of when they were infected. But often talking to people who contracted the virus before there was a test for it, any number of times that this could have happened. And it seemed like almost everyone in that situation that I spoke to had a theory. And they've had so long to think about this, you know, and in a way, you probably have to come up with a narrative in order to process everything.
In terms of that survivor's guilt, because there's another time period, it's more recent, in 2015, and we do meet one of the characters who seems to have survived, or is at least living with it. But there are health implications as a result of the drugs, the AZT, and various different things as well. And I met a gentleman recently. It was actually on an end of life show that we had done, and it was on the mindset that when you lived through that period in the 1980s, you lived expecting to die. But then if you survived, you have to completely change everything and go, now I have to live and I have to age and I have to deal with all of the health issues of aging, as well as the health repercussions of what happened.
And it's not just psychological, because people had lost their careers. You know, they had quit their jobs in order to die. Or, you know, they couldn't work anymore. And then they're, you know, preparing for death. Why would you keep working? Now you're better. You have a 10-year gap. Some people had cashed out on their life insurance early. You know, all kinds of repercussions. And then, the health repercussions, you know, geriatric AIDS study is a new and burgeoning field. And I think that people don't necessarily understand that. They feel like, oh, it's not a big deal anymore. There's medication for it. And it's, you know, issues with osteoporosis, issues with so many other things, all the side effects from all the medications. It's, you know, there are a lot of people now living with it. There are 1.1 million Americans living with HIV. And, you know, from many different populations and of many different ages. And of course, for this book, I was mostly interested in survivors from that initial wave from the gay community.
We're speaking with author Rebecca Mackay here on KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore's Radio Book Club, a monthly collaboration, and her new novel is The Great Believers. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore.
So you have the story of Yale and his cohort of friends is very powerful and very emotional. And then you have shorter sections, you know, that alternates with the 2015 time period, where you have Nora, who's the model, and who was the model in Paris back in the teens and 20s. What did that give to the book? I mean, why not stay in the 80s the whole time? You know, what did you think? What was the necessary element that having these two time periods you think gave the book?
Yeah. And by two, you mean the 80s and 2015.
Yeah.
The World War One era sort of Paris is talked about, but we don't go there. I initially was writing only about the 80s. It was really Yale's story. And I wrote about 150 pages in of just Yale. And then a couple of things. I was feeling a bit claustrophobic in terms of his point of view, what he could end up knowing, how the story could end with him as the main character, as the point of view character. I really wanted something in the future, and I didn't know if I would put that at the end of the book or what I was going to do with it. I also started having some, well, I didn't start. I had been having all along some real questions about appropriation and about whether I had a right to tell a story like this. And that's something I could talk about all day. But one of my answers to that question was, I felt like I could do a better job and have more of a quote unquote right to tell the story if it were a broader story, if there were other characters in there, and I weren't just representing, this one point of view. So I put in someone who demographically is more like myself, you know, a straight woman, emotionally, my personality, I'm much more like Yale and I'm much less like Fiona. But went in, wrote her sections and wove them in to the early part of the book and then continued from there. But that gap of 30 years, I love playing with gaps in time. Being able to talk about, for one thing, you know, that survivor's guilt and the long-term repercussions of this virus. And being able to meet characters, several different characters, at vastly different points in their lives. Just that on a craft perspective, a character development perspective, was really fascinating to me.
Well, that character Fiona, we do meet her in the 80s. She's the sister of the man who dies. That's the opening sequence, is his memorial service. And then we learn about how his family had rejected him, but she stuck with him. And then we meet her again in 2015. And you really see the repercussions of the AIDS crisis on her. She was a straight woman, but she was part of this entire community. I mean, you explained there about character development, but when you were doing your interviews and the folks who had survived the AIDS crisis, did you meet many people like that who weren't directly part of, say, the gay men's community, who were also deeply impacted?
Yeah, absolutely. A number of women who, they might have been part of the gay community, they might have been, you know, lesbians, and really interesting things happening, at least in Chicago, where, you know, the gay community and the lesbian community had not always gotten along, and suddenly really coming together and incredible grassroots stuff happening from the lesbian community. Also straight women who, you know, because they worked in healthcare, because they had friends, because they worked in the arts for any number of reasons, became, you know, battlefield nurses in a way. And, you know, lost, you know, in some cases, maybe it's just one close friend. In some cases, it was friend after friend after friend after friend. I did interview those people. And in the very short time that the book has been out in the world, I've been hearing from a lot of those women, you know, coming up to me after I've talked about the book, after I've read something. Last night I was reading in DC and a woman came up to me and wanted to tell me she had been in the dance community, which is hit harder than almost any other group, I think. And, you know, these are people, I'm not speaking about that person, but I think these are people walking around with, you know, the same kinds of PTSD that you might have from having been in a war and having, you know, held the hands of, you know, 15 dying compatriots. this is what, you know, this was a war. And a lot of these people were also out in the street in these protests that were very combative and very dangerous situations.
That's the impression I got from Fiona in 2015. I said, that is a woman who had PTSD. I mean, you never say that term, I think, in the book describing her, but that seems to be just what she's dealing with 30 years later.
Yeah, and it's really affected her life. It's affected her relationship with her daughter. It affects her relationships with men, with her romantic partners, with straight men. She's messed up.
Well, one of the lines that really got to me in the book was, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but Fiona has, she's one of these people who nursed her brother and then his lover and then several other people, you know, so she lost half dozen at least, you know. So when she's with her husband, and I think they're in counseling or something, and they said, you know, why are you scared to love me, or why are you scared to love him? And she says, I'm scared you're going to die.
Yeah.
And she meant that.
Yeah.
Like, I can't love you. You're going to die.
Right. And not just, I'm scared that you're going to die, so I'm scared to love you, but I'm scared that if I love you, then you will die as a result. You know, that was, you know, I think she sort of had this pattern of, you know, her brother died, so she really adopted his partner, who then died. So then she really adopted some friends who then died. You know, and how do you not deep down sort of start to feel that you are, you know, causing it to happen in some way, even though you know rationally that that can't be the case.
So I was hoping we could hear you read. And this scene you're going to read is Fiona in 2015. And she's in the apartment of Richard Campo. Maybe you can tell a little bit about who Richard is and what she finds in that apartment.
Yeah, I'm not giving anything away here. Although I'm reading from Midway, just the Richard stuff, I'm not giving anything away that you wouldn't know within 20 pages. But we first meet him in 1985, and he seems just like a kind of creepy amateur photographer. He's always taking photos of everyone. They're good photos, but he's always looking around with his camera. Just a few pages later, when we're in 2015, learn that he has become world famous as a photographer, partly for his work chronicling the AIDS epidemic. He's getting ready for a major career retrospective in Paris. And Fiona, who is in Paris to track down her estranged daughter, who has vanished into a cult, whole thing that we haven't even talked about, is staying with Richard and with Richard's much younger boyfriend. So, she's alone in his apartment at some point, and he has, she's seen these a little bit before. He has photo albums just of snapshots, and it's kind of intriguing to her that this man whose photography is world famous has kept his just, you know, snapshots from the 80s. There were probably 20 albums on the shelf, a fact Fiona hadn't absorbed that first day. Rows of black leather, brown leather, colored canvas. Boxes full of slides as well, but she wouldn't mess with those. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them up. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater. Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terrence Robinson, Nico's Terrence. How odd, she must have put this bulletin together herself, but she didn't remember it. Jonathan Bird, Dwight Summer, there were so many of them, so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store, and then when they discovered its mission, say something like, "Oh, I remember that time." Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. "I knew someone whose cousin had it," they'd continue. "Did you ever see Philadelphia?" And they'd shake their heads in dismay. How could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard, that they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust, a mass murder of neglect and antipathy, that when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here in her hand, a stack of ghosts.
That's author Rebecca Mackay reading from her brand new novel, The Great Believers. Now, the city in question there is Chicago in the 1980s. The character Fiona was in 2015 in Paris. There is another city that gets a mention, and it's Boulder, Colorado, as the home of a cult. So,
yeah, we don't come off too good here. I don't know.
Fiona's daughter, as you said earlier, ends up in a cult, and it's in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
I don't know. That's funny. I wanted somewhere that's, you know, kind of seemed like
cultish.
A great... No. Somewhere that seemed like a really great place for her daughter to go spend the summer, you know, after her freshman year of college, and it would be great. But then the kind of place where, like, you're in a city, but there are hills around, there's stuff out there, who knows? Of course, it's completely fictional. I did research on the Boulder Farmers Market to make sure I had, like, their hours of operation right before I said, like, that I did research on, but I completely made up the cult.
But did you do any research, though, into cults and kind of mind control? Because that's actually quite significant, because that's how Fiona, well, it's not why she's estranged from her daughter, but that's a big part of why she's disappeared from her life for many years.
I specifically did research on one cult that I will not name, the reason being that cults make a lot of their money on litigation. They will sue anyone for anything. So I changed enough details that they can't get me if I don't say their name. But I did a lot of research on a cult that I've become aware of that exists in a very different geographic region. And so I chose Boulder because they're not here, largely. There are a lot of places they aren't. So that's only part of my excuse. Certainly changed a lot of stuff, but really some of the core things about this group that they really seemed in many ways like hippies, and it seems kind of idyllic from the outside, and then you get closer and it's not, were very much based on some research that I did.
Well, there's enough ambiguity there that you won't get sued.
Yeah. I can tell you off the air.
So the lifestyle... The gay lifestyle in Chicago and many other cities at the time was, you had discos. Like when Yale gets to Chicago in the early 80s, you know, he's looking back from 1986 to when he first gets there. It's like mind blowing, you know, that you can be kind of gay in public and gay in these nightclubs. And so you have this amazing lifestyle going on, amazing things that maybe were never available to people like Yale in the past, you know, young kids who were moving to the city and seeing this. But at the same time, the AIDS crisis is happening, and it's like two different currents are happening in that culture at the same time.
Right. I was really interested, and this is where the Paris in the 20s thing comes in. I was really interested in both of those cities as meccas for, in the case of, you know, pre-World War I Paris. We tend to think more about the Americans who went over, the writers after the war, the lost generation. But actually before World War I, a lot of visual artists going, Soutine, Modigliani, Fujita, people from all over. We tend to call that group the École de Paris. And they got there. They make this new chosen family in this wonderful place. They have all these resources. And then World War I and the influenza come through and just decimate that population. Very different, but a lot of similarities. And so this woman, Nora, who's looking back on that time, is really able to sympathize with Yale and his friends and what they're going through. It feels to her like she's seeing her past relived and played out in some ways. But similarly, Chicago, as a mecca, as a place where people came, and, you know, in the years between Stonewall and AIDS, you have things getting, they weren't always great. And there's some, you know, even early on in my book, there's some violence, there are all kinds of things going wrong, but things are getting better and better and better. And then AIDS comes through. But yeah, with Yale, you know, I have him, he grows up in Michigan, and, you know, in a small town in Michigan. And then he goes to the University of Michigan. And I did actual research on, was there a gay bar in Ann Arbor in the 70s when he'd have been there? And I, you know, Googled it, not knowing what I would find. And God bless, this person had written this long account, personal account of the one gay bar in Ann Arbor in the 70s that seemed really depressing. And, the windows were full of kind of half-dead potted geraniums to block the view. And I loved that. I mean, it's terrible, but, you know, love in quotes. I loved it so much.
As a writer, you loved it.
As a writer, I loved it, right? And so I made sure to put that in. But, yeah, he gets to Chicago, and there are, like you said, there are discos, and there are bars, and there are the Belmont Rocks, which is this place where these rocks right on Lake Michigan, kind of below street level, so no one can see these rocks from up above. You'd have to be down on them. So it becomes this amazing cruising sunbathing spot where you can be outside in the daylight, you know, with your boyfriend. And that, you know, that's a revelation to Yale particularly. And then so much of that is taken away.
Well, Rebecca Mackay has been our guest at the Radio Book Club for this month, and her new novel is The Great Believers. And we've more information online at news.kgnu.org. Now, do subscribe to our podcast if you have not yet done so, particularly after hours at the Radio Book Club, because we'll have Rebecca join us there for more conversation. But as we always do at the end of our book club segment, Arsene, we tell people what we're reading next. And for August,
We're going to read Rough Beauty by Karen Ovenen. She's a CU professor, but this is about her time in the mountains, living in the mountains and different things that happened to her up there. She lived in Jamestown. Her cabin was caught in a fire, and the town had to pitch in to help her. And it's just a kind of a really unique story. It's Colorado Mountain Story.
Well, that is our selection for the month of August, and Karen will join us at 9 o'clock on August 23rd. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast as well as After Hours at the Radio Book Club, because we're going to have more conversation with Rebecca Mackay. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, as always, is my co-host, and I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU.